What does a room say about a person, a time, a class, a society? To mark the publication of 60 Remarkable Rooms of the National Trust this spring, interior design expert Michelle Agundahin and Trust curator Lucy Porton met in Vita Sackville West's characterful writing room at Sissinghurst in Kent. Lucy Porton's words are read by Olivia Vinnell, and the conversation opens with Michelle Agundahin, whose words are read by Akia Henry.
Stepping into Vita's writing room here at Sissinghurst is profoundly sensory. It's as if she just left it. My goodness. These are her notebooks, her pots, her memorabilia, her life. Even the way it smells. Just being here feels like such an honour.
It's easy to imagine Vita working here. The fresh garden scents floating in from outside, the sound of birdsong. There are descriptions of her in the evening, silhouetted against the window, her cigarette smoke curling around her.
This was one of the first rooms Vita renovated at Sissinghurst after she was prevented from inheriting her ancestral home of Knoll, 25 miles or 40 kilometres or so away, by primogeniture rules stopping it from being passed down to women. Vita loved Knoll and was deeply saddened that she couldn't inherit it. But she's made her writing room here at Sissinghurst feel personal and authentic.
Vita was no ordinary country gentlewoman. She defied convention in life and love. She was a best-selling author, poet and broadcaster, and a passionate gardener. Her relationships, including with fellow author Virginia Woolf, and her refusal to conform, alongside her challenge to gender norms, have made her a queer icon. Vita poured herself into Sissinghurst, and her writing room reflects her creative spirit.
I always think the thing that makes a home is a series of layers and textures. So here, it's the number of rugs that she has on the floor, the super-thick elephant cord fabric on the daybed. You know, someone like Vita would have chosen that very specifically.
It's where she places them as well. Some things are one-off and feel unique, but there's also a kind of rhythm created by the items she has in greater numbers, like the many blue Persian ceramics peppered around the space. And, of course, she's surrounded herself with books.
I find books so personal. I love looking at other people's bookshelves because then you're telling me what you love, what you're interested in, your hopes, dreams, and desires. I have to confess, I keep my own books in the basement where nobody can see them.
I'm endlessly fascinated by the things we surround ourselves with and how there's an element of comfort in their personal messaging. Perhaps you don't want books in a shared space. Maybe the place for them is further into a house where the rooms become gradually more intimate and personal to you and more is revealed. Using that logic, a library is quite an intimate space.
It's interesting that Vita had a writing room, or a room of one's own, as Virginia would have said. It would have been quite rare and very much a privilege. Yet since the pandemic, we're all revisiting how we use rooms and what we use them for. We realise that we need them for retreat and renewal, as well as for writing or anything else.
The pandemic adjusted our thinking about well-being, didn't it? Home became much more important, as did access to outdoor spaces. When you're spending a lot more time at home, you suddenly think, what is the space I've created for myself, and what do I need it to do for me and my family?
I think the point of home is to hold your authentic self. When our homes suddenly had to fulfil lots of different functions, we began to realise that they could be so much more than somewhere you left in the morning and collapsed back into after the day was done. Much of the work I do now is around the idea of home as a tool for health and how our nervous system reacts and responds to the space around us before our conscious brain is even aware of it.
The pandemic was a perfect example of a moment in time which collectively reframed our thinking. For instance, it's become more important to think more about how sensory we want our spaces to be, discovering the colours we find more harmonious.
That's where our attention should be. I push back against fickle trends, that's just marketing, but some design ideas do endure. Biophilia, our instinct to connect with nature, echoes the arts and crafts movement. Minimalism links to Japanese Zen and modernism. Even sustainability has roots in post-war thrift. These aren't trends, they're just barometers of life. But if you design with those in mind, you're designing for well-being, which is always going to be authentic and on trend.
Designers have always drawn inspiration from different cultures, and they constantly borrow from others. The rooms Robert Adam designed at Austerlitz in London were influenced by his grand tour through Europe, which was all about absorbing classical art and architecture. We still create spaces in that way today, only now it's easier with instant access to images and ideas online.
Social media, in a way, has democratized what's available, which is good. My only fear is that at the same time, it can make design seem very superficial. It becomes reduced to getting the look rather than a deeper understanding of the power inherent in surrounding yourself with things of personal meaning.
But there's a bit of association that comes with that too. Perhaps you want to be associated with a certain cultural way of life or a particular craftsperson. Or maybe if you've got a more modern home and you want to make it feel as though there's an element of age to some part of it, an appreciation of an older thing.
In the past, taste was a kind of class code, wasn't it? There were certain looks that represented wealth and nobility. I think now our choices should mirror our personal truths. Homes that nurture well-being are always in good taste. So here at Sissinghurst in the writing room, do we say Vita has good taste? It's almost a moot point to me. But is that room gloriously her? Absolutely.
In earlier periods, grand houses often hired royal craftspeople, perhaps woodcarvers like Grinling Gibbons, 1648 to 1721, to align with elite taste. Later, newer money followed suit, using designers with aristocratic clients like Robert Adam, 1728 to 1792. Over time, taste became more democratic, thanks to mass production and designs from creators like William Morris, 1834 to 1896, became more available to more people. But although these designers are wonderful, I think it often means the personality of the person who actually lived in the space is slightly lost to us. How much of the Child family do we see in the Robert Adam interiors at Austerlitz Park in London, or of the owners at Kedleston in Derbyshire, or Saltram in Devon? Are we seeing more of the designer than the family who lived there in the room decoration? You can't help but contrast those rooms with Vita's writing room, where she is so visible in the decoration and surrounded herself with distinctive, carefully chosen objects. You sense her personality more.
When I'm thinking about design, I always start with a feeling. Then I work with the bone structure of the room, the aspect, the light, the way it ventilates, and the feeling you want to create within it. If your room is blessed with a good bone structure, good proportions, windows, views, or architectural detail, you can play off that. If not, then you have to consider what you can do to make a better foundation. But I always see it as a series of layers. You start with what I call the envelope of the room, the walls and floors as your canvas. Whereas some people tend to buy a lamp and try and make a whole room work around that, which I think is a bit like buying a pair of earrings and then trying to find a dress to match. But it's also important to work out what the threads connecting your preferences are before you start work. What colours and textures do you like? Raw wood or painted wood? Rough or smooth? Take time and really delve into all of that. It's also important not to consider a room in isolation, because rooms are experienced in motion, from different vantage points and angles, looking through from one to the other. There needs to be a conversation between rooms, giving consideration to how your public and private spaces interconnect.
I think some of the authenticity you get in spaces with no association with rank or wealth are actually some of the most beautiful in their simplicity. Like the Loughwood Meeting House in Devon, which is a Baptist chapel built in 1653. A church might have just whitewashed walls and plain pews, but because of the passage of time and the people who came there, who gathered together in a place of harmony, I think there's a sort of trace of that peace and tranquility that leaves a mark.
Yes, I think authenticity is the key word. Rooms that speak of the people who use them are the most impactful to me. Stepping into Vita's creative sanctuary today, I feel like an interloper, as though we wouldn't be allowed in here ordinarily because we're not her mates. Even though right now, I can pretend I am.
I like to think that we would have been.
60 Remarkable Rooms of the National Trust by Elizabeth Green, Lucy Porton and James Rothwell, with an introduction by Michelle Gundahan, is available from April from most high street and online booksellers, most National Trust shops, and through the online shop nationaltrust.org.uk/shop.